KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is a pretty accomplished writer and observer of the culture herself, and got a chance in working with Anthony Bourdain to work as assistant. And basically, she was the person who kept all the trains running for him. She is the author recently of the book Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. And she also hosts a terrific podcast called Carb Face. I'm talking to Lori Woolover. Lori, thank you so much for doing the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You really use the book as a way to kind of chart his emotional growth. And was that the way you set out to do it?
The initial idea with the oral biography was to just simply tell the full story of a person who told a lot of his own story. But if you've read Kitchen Confidential, which many millions of us have, you know that the story touches down a couple of points in his youth, and then really jumps right into the kitchen years, understandably. And that's really where the meat of his story was up until the point of publication in 2000. So there are a lot of pieces of his life story that he hadn't told, that were not these carefully crafted stories that he had been telling about himself for years and years. So in order to create a fuller picture, it was really just, let's do a chronological treatment from beginning to end. And what became apparent very quickly in starting the interview process is that it really was a story of one man's kind of emotional growth, or in some cases, lack thereof. I mean, you know, I have a lot of respect for Tony. He was a friend and a mentor and my boss for a long time. But as you'll see, if you read the book, there are a lot of people who noticed that he had some pretty big emotional gaps and some pretty big, you know, places where he just kind of never grew up in a way, or had what some call a very beautiful romantic view of the world. But, you know, in some cases, almost a childlike expectation of the world that often led to a lot of disappointment.
Wow, I mean, you said it so beautifully, because I knew him, as you know, a little bit, and I first met him in 2003 when he came on to do the show for the Bobby Gold Mysteries, and I was shocked at how nervous he was, and he sort of got that under control as I spent a bit more time with him. But I could always tell what state he was in by if his hands were shaking or not. And I always thought of him as being this guy who went from being somebody who pretended to be a worldly sophisticate but was really a scared kid to somebody who became a worldly sophisticate who was still a scared kid.
One of the most surprising things that people are taking away from the book is this look behind the scenes at a guy who, if you only knew him from reading his writing and watching him on television, he was the most charismatic, cool, funny, confident, easygoing guy. And he could certainly be that, and he could certainly perform that. And in the right company, he truly was that guy. But he also was, as you note, oftentimes very nervous and very anxious. He had a lot of social anxiety. I think that being a cook really suited him, because you're with sort of your crew, you know, you're not out for public consumption, you're always around people, but you know who they are, and everyone's got a defined role within the hierarchy of the kitchen. And then being a writer, you know, it was also a way for him to kind of manage that social anxiety. You can kind of write yourself into whatever role that you want to play and any way in which you would like to present yourself to the world. And then being a television presence, you know, you've got the work of highly talented producers, cinematographers, and editors that are really taking the best 46 minutes of 12 or 20 or 40 hours of television. And so, again, making you look the most confident, the coolest, the funniest, the most charismatic, and cutting away all of the parts where you're self-doubting or your jokes don't land or you're just not feeling it. So he was already a very interesting person, just as something to be consumed on the screen or on the page. But the real 360 human was even that much more interesting and that much more complex.
Yes, as you were talking, I was thinking about that point in the book where Eric Repair talks about when the two of them went skiing. He said that Tony was the best kind of an okay skier, and Eric was much more expert. But when the show was cut together, it came across as the complete opposite.
That's the beauty of having a show with your name on it and, you know, people that are in your service. They can make you the better skier, you know, the better, I won't say dancer, because I'm not sure Tony ever consented to dancing on film or not, but, you know, better at any number of things. You know, he really was in charge of how his image was portrayed over close to 20 years of television. He was willing to be vulnerable. He was always honest, but he was always in charge of, you know, how he came across and what message he was sending in the final edit. As you'll see in the book, he was really, really involved in the edit in a way that sometimes was really tough for these guys that worked for him, the directors, the producers, the editors themselves. Tony was super opinionated and sometimes very, very critical to guys who have been doing this their whole lives, you know, and as a lot of them said, you know, it was frustrating, it was difficult. And then more often than not, he was actually right. It was coming at it from an outsider's perspective, but he knew what he wanted. And often his ideas about where to cut and how to frame the story made for the best possible episode.
Well, it's interesting reading the stuff in the book, and the book we're talking about, by the way, is Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. Its author is my guest, Laurie Wolever. Is reading the stuff with Mo Fallon and Nick Brigden, who I know, and hearing them talk about what he was like, and especially near the end, and then just sort of charting him going from one obsession to another, from jiu-jitsu to Aja Argento, and just so he would just hold forth on these things forever, and they just wanted to hear him talk about something else.
Yeah, if you were not a jiu-jitsu practitioner, it truly did not matter. Tony would just talk to you about a match he had watched or one that he was training for or some new move that he had learned or some gruesome injury that he had had. And he could make a lot of things interesting. But after a while, you're just like, dude, come on, you know, you gotta, you know, change it up a little bit. So what I did, you know, and he was trying to get everyone around him involved with jiu-jitsu too. And he would, you know, pay for your first few classes. And you know, really, I think it probably helped a lot of people in their careers to be involved with jiu-jitsu. It was never something that I was going to do for myself, but I did briefly make my 8-year-old son. I got him into jiu-jitsu as a way to sort of be able to understand more of what Tony was talking about and a way to kind of understand this world that was everything to him for a while. As it turned out, my 8-year-old son was like, can I please not be the tool in your career advancement plan here? I don't actually really like this that much. But this is something that I didn't necessarily see when he was alive, but he had lifelong addictive tendencies. And sometimes that was a very useful and worthwhile thing. Jiu-jitsu arguably was one of the healthier obsessions. His body got very healthy. His mind was very focused. He was happy. You know, he was around people doing something that allowed him to blow off steam and come to work much more focused and happier. And then, of course, there were less healthy obsessions, among them, you know, heroin, which he was very frank about in Kitchen Confidential and afterward, you know, any number of other drugs that were interesting to him. Smoking cigarettes, you know, there were times when the work became an obsession. And then, of course, you know, his romantic relationships, and that's touched on as a through line throughout his whole life. And that gets touched on in the book from his high school girlfriend, whom he followed to college. He graduated high school a year early to be able to join her in college. His second wife, Otavia, you know, there were some sort of obsessive qualities there in that relationship. And then the last major relationship with Aja Argento is very well documented in the book as being an object of real obsession for Tony.
I just wanted to ask you what your first meeting with him was like, because if you could see that he was capable of these kind of long-term sort of fascinations when you first sat down to talk with him about going to work with him.
Yeah, that was not apparent to me at first. Now, the first time I met him was back in 2002. I had been Mario Batali's assistant for a long time, and I was wrapping up that job, and Tony was looking for someone to help him edit and test recipes for Anthony Bourdain's Leal cookbook, which was his first cookbook. And he had no longer was the acting chef at Leal restaurant in New York, but he still was sort of, you know, on paper, the official chef. And he just didn't really have the time to write a cookbook start to finish. It's always a collaborative process, whether or not it's acknowledged. So Mario recommended me because I had done that kind of work with Mario for years. And so our first meeting was about that book. And the impression that Tony made at that time was someone who was very busy, who really, you know, was there to have as quick a meeting as possible. I was struck by how sort of quiet and mild-mannered he was. You know, I had read Kitchen Confidential like everyone else, and I think I had seen a little bit of his television presence. So I was expecting that kind of brash, you know, confident television guy. And he was really, you know, much more socially awkward, again, you know, difficulty making eye contact, and really just seemed kind of uncomfortable in his own skin and just wanted to get the meeting done as quickly as possible. You know, very polite, very kind, very warm, but also clearly just vibrating with nervous energy. So that was my first impression of him. And it wasn't until 7 or 8 years later, when I went to work as his assistant, that I realized that he had this capacity for obsessive rabbit holes with whatever it was that he was on at the time.
Yeah, because one of the things that you chart so well is just the ebb and flow of his mood. And I want to talk to you about one of the chapters that was my particular favorite, because it's about a line of consistent sort of generosity from him. And that's chapter 27. I knew I could write the story I needed to write, what he's helping people to get published and working with David Simon on Treme. And there's a thing in him where the people he really liked, he wanted to see them do well.
You know, I can only speculate, but I think he was really grateful to whatever forces, and they were, I think, random forces, but also a lot of talent, a lot of patience, and a lot of hard work that found him suddenly successful, suddenly financially solvent, maybe not quite a household name, but a very, suddenly very well-known writer and television host at the age of 44. I think he was hugely grateful for that. And I think there was a kind of a paying it forward to the people around him. You know, I think he knew what kind of a platform he had. He knew the power of his name and his voice. It didn't cost him anything, even if it did cost him something, to lift up the people around him. He was very invested in helping people to get the attention that they might not have otherwise. It was always really just lovely to see and lovely to be on the receiving end of when he saw someone that he thought had promise and talent, that he was very, very willing to make connections, make introductions. It was really why he established his own book imprint, Anthony Bourdain Books, which was an imprint of Echo, which is itself an imprint of HarperCollins, so that he could offer the opportunity, the people that he met, to tell their stories. I think he published probably about 20 books over the course of his time with the imprint. You know, they were people who were friends and associates and people he met along the way who had a unique point of view and just needed access to a platform like Tony's.
Well, because of all the stuff we've been hearing about him since his unfortunate death, about the dark moods, and the documentary sort of deals with that sort of darkness he was capable of. But we don't get much of a window into that generosity and that also need to not talk about himself sometimes. I mean, he could talk about himself a lot, as we know, but to just not do that, that's why I wanted to point this out in the book, because I think it's a really important key to who and what he was that we don't hear about so often.
Some people talk about this in the book. Eric Repair talks about it and a few others, that he had really beautiful manners, you know, and this whole kind of brash bad boy, you know, kitchen pirate thing. That was a facet of his persona, and certainly more so in his younger years. But underneath it, he was a very, you know, well-mannered, very considerate and elegant person who was raised by people for whom manners and, you know, good taste were very important. So that was, I think that was part of his kit of good manners, was to do kind and generous things for people, but not to draw attention to it. I think he would have been mortified to have people talking about how generous and what a large spirit he had. I mean, there were any number of people who needed money. You know, he was always throwing money to a Kickstarter for a worthy, you know, an artistic cause, or someone who had a car accident, or there was one of his really very gifted editors who died quite young and left two very young children behind. And Tony didn't have much of a personal relationship with this guy, but all I had to say was, listen, you know, this guy was sick. He died. He has two young children and a spouse. And Tony wrote a huge check to this guy's family. And that was just a very routine thing. You know, I think he got so many people telling him how great he was all the time for the work that had his name on it. And I think it was a pleasure in a way and a comfort to be able to help people without having to take credit for it.
Clearly, there's a lot to talk about here. We're going to take a break. My guest is writer and part of the world of Tony Bourdain, Laurie Wolliver. Her book is Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography. I'm glad she's here. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is Laurie Wolliver. We're talking about the book Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography. And again, we were talking about before the break, his generosity. What's fascinating about the book is that I found myself thinking about the opening chapter 57, All Okay, when he's talking to Michael Steed. He says, just a little discretion about the way his life is leaking into the tabloid. And just sort of thinking about, you know, what his brother Chris was saying about their early life, about what their parents were, about trying to keep appearances and pretending they were one thing when they were really something else. And it's interesting the way you get those things that sort of dovetail in the book. We can see where he grew up just in that exchange with Michael shortly before he took his own life.
I think he learned from his mother at a relatively young age how to manage appearances and how to manage expectations and how to keep up with what the public expects. There's a lot of detail, really, wonderful, interesting stories from Tony's brother, Christopher Bourdain, in the beginning of the book about how the family had a big, beautiful house. The boys both went to a private school. They had this expensive, unusual, imported British car that they drove. But, you know, the car was always breaking down and they ran out of money to finish the renovation of the house. And, you know, the bill collectors were always chasing them about the orthodonture or the school tuition. And so things weren't always what they seemed. As well, Tony's mother very deeply hid the fact that she was Jewish. I mean, she hid it from her own children until they were into their teens and they happened to see a document that had her real name on it. She had said that her maiden name was Saxon, S-A-X-O-N. I mean, it doesn't get any waspier than that. But in fact, her last name was Saxman, S-A-C-H-S-M-A-N. And, you know, Chris and Tony over the years sort of uncovered all of these ways in which she had taken a step sideways from the truth about where she grew up, even to the point of obscuring the fact that she and Tony's dad, Pierre, were married in a synagogue. She had presented that they were married in a church. I mean, you know, it was the time in the United States in the 1950s and 60s when it still was a social liability to be Jewish. The deeper she got into the charade, there was less and less reason to come out of it. So there is a parallel. I mean, it's not explicitly shouted out in the book, but it makes a lot of sense that Tony would overshare in some ways and be very, very frank about who he was and what his life was like, and then keep, you know, some things very, very private. And I think that to have his romantic troubles splashed across the front page of the European tabloids and potentially the National Enquirer was a very, very difficult prospect for him to consider.
There are things about Tony that people wanted to keep to themselves. A lot of people felt like they got some part of him that others didn't, and they kind of held on to that as a way of just sort of keeping a part of him with them because he was so public. And, you know, there were times he'd go out and he just, as often as not, he wanted to have dinner at the Time Warner Center and have a steak because that way he wouldn't have to see people he didn't want to deal with. And that need to sort of like keep a part of him alive, even before he passed, was something part of him that was special and not known to the public, is something that you as often as not get from people to talk about.
Yeah, I think these are conversations that I certainly would not have had. There were a lot of details and a lot of things that came to light after his death that I think people would have kept to themselves. I think that there was this sense of protecting Tony. I think we were all kind of siloed from each other in some ways. When you're trying to, you know, maintain whatever the illusion is, that, you know, if you know people aren't talking about you, you know, then you can sort of keep your story straight. Not to say that he was lying all the time, but it just, I think he showed the parts of himself that he wanted to different people. And I think there was this, I don't know, there was always this sense of loyalty that, you know, that he engendered in people and that he made clear was very, very important to him, that you be loyal. And in return, he was very, very loyal to the people around him. So I think part of that was, you know, no one wanted to be the person that was gossiping about Tony because, you know, God forbid it get back to him. He had that kind of hold on people, you know, and I think it was without him ever saying it directly, it was you wanted to protect him and you wanted to not get caught talking about him. You know, he loved spy stuff and he loved subterfuge and he loved the Cold War history and the CIA. And I think he, you know, he had a good time sort of acting as a double agent or, you know, extracting information from other people or playing dumb. And, you know, he writes about that in Kitchen Confidential. And I think those are tactics that he continued to employ as he developed his television career. You know, you have three or four different sort of core groups of directors and producers and cinematographers that work together. And there's competition among them and there's sniping and, you know, just the kind of stuff that goes on in any workplace. And so everyone wanted to be in Tony's favor. Everyone wanted to, you know, go on the best shoots. And so I think he had a good time kind of, you know, using that to his advantage and getting intel and getting, you know, he loved gossip. He loved to know the backstory of other people's, you know, lives. So I think it was in everyone's interest to kind of keep Tony's secrets for themselves, to protect him and also probably to protect their own professional interests. So it really was only after he died that everyone felt more comfortable telling all of their stories. And I'm sure there are things that people held back and I don't begrudge anyone. And there are a few things that I know that are not in the book because there is this sense of just wanting to protect him, remembering that, you know, he has living family. He has a brother, he has a niece and nephew and a sister-in-law and, you know, ex-wives and a daughter. Most important, the idea is that, you know, we do want to make a very full and complete and honest portrait of a man who would be the first to say that he was flawed. But every tiny little piece of dirty laundry doesn't necessarily need to be out there. I think that's a lasting legacy of his, you know, that you have to keep a little bit of something back.
Well said. It's the treatment. My guest, who just beautifully said that, is Lori Woolover. Her book is Bourdain, the Definitive Oral Biography. And you just mentioned something I wanted to get to, so I'm glad you brought it up. You had a chance to talk to Ariana's daughter, and just her insights, her observations about him were really, really interesting because you got this real sense of freedom that he had around her from the conversations you had with her in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I had the pleasure of spending a little bit of time with them together when we were writing our cookbook Appetites that came out in 2016. I spent some time in the home with them developing recipes. We would have people over to, you know, test things out that we were cooking. He was so happy around her. He was able just to be goofy and silly. He would talk about her, you know, whenever he was on the road. That was one of the things he would talk a lot about is, you know, what kind of a gift should he get her where he is and what's she doing? And he got her into jujitsu. So he would talk about, you know, how great she was at it and talk about, you know, what she was doing in school. I mean, he was just, it was as true and deep and real a relationship as I think anyone, you know, observed him to be in his life. He was a really devoted dad. And I think even more so for having had to be away so much so that the time that he was with her was that much more precious. There was no reason not to be his best, most authentic self with her. And she's, you know, she's a really, really smart, really great kid. And I felt very lucky to get to spend some time with her for this book.
A word that comes up from time to time in people describing him, but I never thought applied to him, was cynical, except in that sort of Balzac way that inside every cynic beats the heart of a true romantic. And I think he would sometimes use that as kind of this thing to keep the world at bay.
Someone says, I think, close to the end of the book, sort of, you know, doing a little bit of a post-mortem, that the world was never going to live up to his romantic expectations. And he was such a romantic, and he would get so enamored of things or so excited about the prospect of something. And it was very hard for the world to live up to that ideal. You know, he could be disappointed again and again, and he would still pick himself up and, you know, get excited about something else. You know, his Twitter bio was one word, enthusiast. Even though I think, you know, most people, when you sit down to think about and describe who he was and what he put out into the world, he was also, of course, deeply cynical and, you know, deeply jaded about most things. But to have that capacity to fall in love with a place, to be totally enamored of a dish or a person. There was a time when we were in Vietnam in 2014 and riding back after a pretty long and pretty intense shoot in this underground cave that people had lived in for years during the war with the United States. Really, really tough shoot. And we were just talking about different places he had been. And he was talking about, he had been in India recently and just describing, you know, the juxtaposition of the beauty and the deep suffering. And he just spontaneously started to cry. And I was flabbergasted. I didn't realize he had that side to him that could be so moved by the memory of beauty that he would cry.
Well, the thing that you get at the book is just the sense of exhaustion. Like I said at the opening, he was pretending to be a worldly sophisticate. By the end, he was one, but he was still the same guy underneath in a lot of ways. And in some fundamental way, although lots of things had changed for him, things in a lot of ways had not changed for him. And he just seemed really worn down by it. And you really get at that in the book, too.
Yeah, very, very tired and yet unable to walk away from the life that he had made for himself. That's, you know, 200 to 250 days traveling a year. That's a huge amount of time. It takes a real toll on your body and on your mind. And he would talk a lot for years and years, was talking about how he wanted to try and do something different. And he just couldn't quite make the break. I think there was a level of addiction to that life. And I think there was a fear of, you know, what would happen if he did slow down, if he was suddenly had to be in one place for any length of time, you know, would he be able to handle it? You know, a lot of people ask me, what do you think he would have done during the pandemic? In some ways, I'm glad he hasn't had to, you know, he didn't have to make that decision or didn't have to suffer through, you know, sitting still. At the same time, I think he would have, you know, just as somebody who was so interested in public health, he was interested in medical oddities. He wrote a book about Typhoid Mary. I wish that he would come back and I could say to him, dude, there's a pandemic. There's been a pandemic going on for almost 2 years. You know, it would be so interesting to him. But yeah, it was absolutely exhausting, that life. He felt this burden of leadership. And in fact, there's a chapter in the book to that effect, that he felt had a burden of leadership that was real, that if he stepped off the train and he stopped making television and he stopped being that guy, what would happen to all the people who had been along with him for the ride for so long? You know, the audience and the network, but also the people who had been, you know, working alongside him for so long. And the truth is, everyone would have been okay. And if we could have had the chance to say, it's okay, get off the train, you know, just take care of yourself, any one of us would have said, it's fine, we'll go work with someone else, you know, just for the chance to still have him around. But that's not how it played out, unfortunately.
The book is Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. My guest is Lori Woolover. Thank you again for doing the show, Lori.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Our recording engineer at KCRW, part of our production staff, is Katie Gilchrist. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
K
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.